Welcome to the Public Orality. On this special edition of the Public Orality, I'm the guest, and the guest host is no stranger to the Public Orality. It's Brown University political science professor, Corey Brettschneider. And the topic is my forthcoming book, The Radical Declaration, An Enlightened American Idea, 5 Essays on the Declaration of Independence.
Hello, this is Corey Brettschneider. The show is called The Public Morality. And my guest today, of course, is none other than Byron Williams, who's normally the host of our show, but today is in the hot seat and going to be subject to some tough questions about his excellent new book. So welcome, Byron, and nice to see you.
Honored to have you sit in, my friend. Honored to have you sit in.
I'm going to just begin, I think, by jumping right in.
Okay.
Tell us, if you could, what motivated you to write this book and how you came up with the title and just the basics. I should just read it to everyone. It's called The Radical Declaration, and the subtitle is An Enlightened American Idea.
Well, my books... You know, I would love to say that, you know, my books come to me as I'm walking down the street and I get hit by a bolt of lightning and a voice cries out, Byron, write this book. That's not quite how it happens for me. So it usually something occurs and then something else occurs and then I get the idea to write the book. So I was at one of my Wake Forest courses that I was teaching. This one was called The Public Theological Voice, where I was combining theological principles with sort of that public morality, the Declaration, the Constitution, things, and the Emancipation Proclamation. So anyway, we were talking about the Declaration, and I asked, is this a radical document?
Right.
And everybody kind of looked around, and two brave souls said no. So, you know, it's one of those sort of pregnant pauses, like, we should say it's a radical document, but we don't want to say that, and we didn't say anything. But two brave souls says, no, it's not. One said, because they borrowed heavily from the Magna Carta, and the other student said, well, it's just words on a piece of paper, doesn't have any relevance to today. I proceeded to go on about a 25-minute soliloquy explaining why this is a radical document. Mm. And then when I got done, it was sort of dead silence. And then one of the students looked at me and said, Professor Williams, you should write that. And that's how it happened.
Those are the best ideas. Let me get into this idea of a radical idea. And I'm going to kind of go through the book. And for your listeners, I mean, they're not going to be surprised to hear me say this. This is a really magisterial work that's got everything from contemporary ideas about voting rights and where we need to move in the future. But it's also a deep look at America's framers, what are sometimes called the founding fathers, and also the sort of contradictions of the ideas that we're going to talk about, the radical ideas and what's actually happened in history. But I do want to start with a challenge that I think some readers and listeners might have, which is, you know, you're so indebted in the radical idea to the Declaration, of course, and even to Thomas Jefferson. So how can it, you know, your radical idea is partly about a promise of equality in addition to a promise of liberty. And so I think a lot of people just listening to this, not having seen how the book develops, might start with just a basic question, which is how can this guy who was a, you know, slaveholder after all, be a hero of a book about equality, even if he penned the words of the Declaration. So what do you think about that?
That's a great question. It's very similar to one that I had a young man at Laney College in Oakland. I was giving a lecture, asked pretty much the same question. And my response to him was, you shouldn't reduce a near-perfect document to the flawed hands that wrote it. So there's two things. Who Thomas Jefferson was and what he did are separate. There's a number of people who've written about the personal Jefferson. And let's be honest, even publicly, Thomas Jefferson was an enigma. I mean, he talked about limited government, but probably he was responsible for the largest expansion of government that we've ever had. I'm thinking about that Louisiana Purchase. You know, he's advocate of liberty, but he held slaves. I mean, He talked about being fiscally conservative, but he lived deeply in debt. So I think on that part of the subject, I think the thing to remember, none of us are as moral as the ideas we hold. And Jefferson is no exception. He just happened to be the guy who came up with this radical idea. Jefferson's imperfections, though, do not diminish, in my view, the radical nature of the idea.
Yeah, and it's one of the nice things that you do in the book is that you're honest about who these authors were, but then you're doing something yourself with these ideas. You're sort of bringing them forward to issues today, like voting rights. And I love the metaphor, and I'm just going to ask you to talk to the listeners about it, of jazz, that jazz really, a kind of deep understanding of it, gives you a way of thinking about how I take it to play with ideas. So do you want to say just something maybe connecting to the comments that you just made about how the jazz metaphor works and how people who seem, you know, so foreign from the idea of jazz like Thomas Jefferson actually contribute to the way the metaphor works?
Well, you think about jazz and syncopation and a lot of jazz is sort of that spontaneity, that creativity. And that has been, for me, the American narrative. Now, I'm going to use my powers of clairvoyance here, or it probably wasn't Jefferson's intention, or I would say the Declaration is beyond anybody's intention at the time, what it's become. But the American narrative has sort of been like jazz. It has been this syncopation, and there's been these solos, and there's been this unpredictability. And each time, like one of the things a lot of jazz performers say, that when they perform live, it's never the same song, you know,
right. And
it's the same with the American narrative. There may be things like this or like that, but it's never the same thing. The Teapot Dome scandal under Harding isn't Watergate. COVID-19 crisis isn't the Civil War. So everything is different. You know, maybe in a macro sense of similarity, but every night is different, and that's how jazz is, and that's how the American narrative has been for me. That's how I see it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, when I was reading the book, I was thinking the metaphor is very powerful, too, as the reader, and I take it as you, as the author, that we inherit these ideas. They were played a certain way in the 18th century, and then, of course, we're going to talk about the 19th century as well. But then they can be reimagined by us in a way that applies to the crises at hand, and we can do a better or worse job. You know, just the fact that you're playing a solo doesn't mean you're going to play it well, and so
well,
it
know,
can
Corey,
be played
if I may,
well.
If I can just jump in there, because you make a great point. When you think about the Declaration, you think about, let's say it you know, William Lloyd Garrison is using July 4th and the Declaration to critique, you know, the hypocrisy of slavery. Frederick Douglass does something very similar. 1861, in January, at his farewell address, Jefferson Davis is justifying leaving the Senate based on his understanding of the Declaration. And a couple months later, I think Abraham Lincoln's in Philadelphia, and he says words to the effect that I've never had a political thought that didn't involve the Declaration of Independence. So my point is, so it becomes this touchstone by which everybody justifies their moral position, but those moral positions are different. So to your point about jazz, it's the same sheet of music, but you know, it's a different way to play it. Coltrane didn't play it the way Charlie Parker played it. Dizzy Gillespie didn't play it the same way Miles Davis played it. And none of them played it like John Philip Sousa. So it's just different.
Yeah. I wanted to kind of go on to the, I mean, I guess if I had any ability as a music critic, I could come up with examples of this. But, you know, there are other people who are taking the metaphor, who are taking the radical idea, playing their own tune with it, but you're extremely critical of them. So one of the things that you rightly lament and think about is the Supreme Court, and it's not only its best moments, but its worst moments. And one of them, I think, is you and I agree, the Shelby County decision, really striking down a fundamental part of this hard-fought for 1965 Voting Rights Act, and saying, you know what, all these protections about local government having to clear voting rights changes to make sure that they're copacetic, that they're not intentionally trying to disenfranchise African-American voters. You mentioned that, and you know, you're not happy with the Roberts Court for doing that. So what do we do? I mean, I want to ask not just about that, but about what we do with people who take the idea. And frankly, it is, I think, probably a majority of the modern Supreme Court, the same ideas that you and I are talking about, the ideals and the aspirations. That's your word that I want to keep coming back to, the aspiration of equality. But then they spin it in a way that's really not, I think, what you and I are talking about. They have an idea of color blindness, for instance, that says that, you know, the moment that you have consciousness of the fact that people are of different races and have faced discrimination or not, depending on that history, we're going to just ignore that, they say, in their idea of color blindness. They're really brutal towards the need for these protections from 1965, with the thought that maybe things have gotten better when we see in many cases like voter ID that they haven't. So what do we do with those who are also trying to use these aspirations, but in ways that you and I at least are worried about?
Well, you know, Corey, I think that part of that is the job of Corey Brettschneider, because and I mean, I'm serious, because part of that is enlightenment. I mean, the thing is that oftentimes, and I see these cases, and I see people looking at the outcome and judging whether or not they like the decision based on the outcome. I mean, my biggest problem with the Shelby case was that Chief Justice John Roberts offered what, in my view, was a sociological opinion to gut Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. You know, it doesn't look at the history and the fact the real proof how bad Roberts got it wrong was, and I'm using the Fourth Circuit's language here, was the, like, and I'm in their case about the North Carolina case, the Fourth Circuit said with almost surgical precision, you know, they went back in, these states that were under the Voting Rights Act went back in to make voting more onerous. And then you see elected officials then try to create a problem that wasn't there. Like, we have this mass voting irregularities, and when the fact of the matter is, you know, you can't win with a declining voter base. That's the real issue. And then you gut the Voting Rights Act. And so, but it gets back to that we have to be a more enlightened populace. It just can't be the outcome that determines whether or not I like something. How did the Supreme Court get there? If I may have still disagreed, but if the Supreme Court would have said, you know, based on our understanding of the 15th Amendment, we think Section 5 should be cutted. But no, Roberts said, oh, we think times are better. That's not your job as a justice to tell me if times are better.
I mean, in a way, this is one instance, a crucial instance, but I think it's throughout the book where you say, look, these people who say they love the Constitution, that they love the idea of America, they're not being true to it. They're sort of making it up by using modern facts at their own convenience. And I'm the one that's really working to understand what actually happened. And when you take it seriously, you have a lot of ideas that are, I'll just use your word again, radical. So that's great. I want to, you know, I think that's a crucial contribution of the book. It's the thing I love about it, and that, you know, really speaks to my way of thinking about American history and political philosophy too, that we can find these ideals in the past. But I want to sort of, as an interviewer, I feel an obligation to give some pushback against both of us. So I'm going to play that role. I mean, you know, there's a lot of sort of response that would say, look, you guys, Byron and Corey, are, you're saying you're radical, you're conservatives. We need a new constitution that is founded on new ideals, and you're sort of stuck in an old way of thinking. And one place I imagine that they would say it, and I think we have good pushback here, is, you know, one of the things that you love in the book is this, you tell the story of the citizenship test and the professor, I believe, who gives it to students,
right,
and sort of, you know, the idea of,
it's Katie,
you know,
Harriger.
We think we know this,
it's Katie,
constitution, but we don't. So tell me about that, and then answer this question. Is citizenship one of those old ideas that just keeps us beholden to insiders and outsiders, and doesn't really allow us to have a full conception of equality and human rights rather than rights of citizenship.
I don't know if you heard me, but that actually was Katie Herricker who gives the citizenship test at Wake Forest. You know, when you came down. But
yes, I met her.
Yeah,
pleased to. Yeah.
So, but I think the point, though, I think the point of that citizenship test, and the story is that each year a colleague of yours and mine, that she each year gives her incoming freshman students a citizenship test, and that the only students, most students flunk, but the majority of students that pass are students from another country. And that's telling in this sense. That, you know, and I will tag along with that. One of my July 4th traditions in North Carolina every year is that I go down to hear the swearing in of new citizens. And, you know, I think I described it as sort of joyous envy. I mean, you see people fighting back tears, you know, because they're about to be citizens. And you and I we're just grandfathered in. And
right. The
problem is, if you do that over time, then you lose sight of what the country stands for. You lose sight of what's important. And as I was saying earlier about, we tend to focus on the outcome of Supreme Court cases. You know, one of my favorite cases is Brandenburg v. Ohio. Not only one, because it was an 8-0 ruling, and one of the eight was Thurgood Marshall in support, but also it was a key lesson, in my view, that abstract speech, no matter how heinous, how reprehensible, is still protected. And it's not just it's a great reminder. It's not the speech you like, and so.
Yeah.
Very much a lot of America is not on what we like, but our barometer to defend America is, can we defend the things we don't like? It's sort of a inverted order to how one looks at stuff, but this is what makes, again, this experiment, this American experiment and this declaration of liberty and equality such a radical proposition.
Do you think, as you were speaking, I was reminded of early on in Trump, in the administration, I wrote a piece called Trump versus the Constitution, partly about how he hadn't read it and certainly didn't understand the Constitution. And somebody wrote back, it was one of these Facebook things, saying nobody reads the Constitution. It was actually a prominent scholar. And my aunt, who's a naturalized citizen, wrote back saying exactly what you're saying. Well, I've read it very closely, and so has everybody who's become a citizen. I mean, does that suggest that maybe we all should be taking... So I know that, you know, there's this great example of students taking it. Should we all take a new citizenship test? Would that be a way of giving sort of new life to the radical ideas that you're talking about?
Well, I went a little further, as you know, I went a little further in chapter one, where I suggested that I think the Declaration should be annual reading.
Yeah.
It should be annually, once a year, you should read the Declaration, and once a year, you should review the Constitution. I mean, one of the tragic, it's a tragic story. It would be funny if it wasn't so tragic, that my other July 4th tradition is to listen to NPR in the morning when they read the entire Declaration of Independence. They have the various readers. So 2017, in addition to reading it, NPR tweeted out line by line the Declaration. And people thought it was some liberal propaganda trying to overthrow Trump, and got vehemently upset. And my point is, it's not pro-Trump or anti-Trump. My point is, when the document that created this nation, when those words are not immediately recognizable, it's a problem.
Right, right. I'm anxious to ask you about some more in the book, but I do want to sort of set the book in the context of this group that I know that you have created, which is really devoted to reading these texts, and you know you're not surprisingly practicing what you preach. You have this group meant to sort of re-energize the radical idea. How is that? Maybe you could just say a word for listeners who haven't heard you talk about it, and how it relates to the themes of the book.
Well, the group was it was my year-end column, and I decided that I didn't want to just I started by saying your previous question, we ought to read these texts annually. And I was writing the piece, and I looked at the piece and I said, this feels a little self-righteous. And so then I got the idea while writing the piece, I'm going to invite some people to join me in this reading. And I was surprised at the number of people who went on this year process, and in which we read the Declaration. We read not all of them, but selected Federalist Papers. We read Benjamin Rush's 1787 speech, which I think is one of the most profound texts in the American narrative, and then we went through the Constitution, and we had people of various social locations, political backgrounds, and we basically had two rules. Rule number one is agreement is overrated, and so you don't have to agree. But rule number two is you must begin every statement, here's how I see it. So you had to take ownership for your position. Like, I couldn't say to you, remember the old Saturday Night Live, you know, Jane, you ignorant slut. I couldn't say that, Corey, that's ridiculous. I had to say, okay, Corey, here's how I see it. Which lets you know that I heard what you said, and I'm responding to what you said. And what that did, those simple rules took out animosity, and it brought in a sort of a friendship. And then the formal end of the class was toward the end of last year, but they have continued as their own group, you know, engaged with each other, talking about current issues. And so that was it in a nutshell.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about that group as you were speaking about the idea of and writing, actually, about the idea of these texts and our sort of common history, our common bond. And, you know, when I was engaging you of what do we do with people who, you know, use these texts for reasons that you and I in the Shelby County case, for instance, don't agree with. And your answer, I thought, was really subtle, you know, that listeners can think about. And it evokes the spirit of the group, the spirit of the book, which is you don't just say you're wrong. You engage through the text in the history and in a dialogue, not in some kind of put down contest. And I mean, to me, that's one of the great things about the book is it talks about these texts as a sort of common dialogue to both, you know, enable a vision of radicalness, but also to create a kind of community at the same time, even with those that we disagree with. So it's so great. And I thought your group, having the honor of speaking to it and seeing it, and you had lots of people there, certainly from different political persuasions, yet devoted to this common study. And with the rules of civility that you're talking about, it really, you know, you made that happen, and glad to hear it's still happening. Let me ask you about another word. We've been talking, I think, if there was one word beyond the radical idea, if there was a word to describe what we've been talking about, it's aspirations, and a word that you use in the book. And then I want to talk about another word that I think is crucial, too, in the book, and that's the word rebirth. You talk a lot about the Civil War, and in particular the three amendments that followed the Civil War, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. So how does that sort of, you know, well after Jefferson's death, that destructive period in American history, and then those three amendments, how do they relate? How do the three amendments relate to the radical idea of the Declaration?
Well, Lincoln's actions leading up and through the Civil War, and his thoughts about secession were based on his understanding of the Declaration of Independence. So I sort of said earlier, Lincoln says in Philadelphia, I have no thought, no political thought, that's not somehow related to the Declaration. And then Lincoln begins what is the most famous speech, the best speech, in my opinion, in American history. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth to this country a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. So that's for Lincoln, for the Civil, I mean, that's the nexus. That's the starting point. Now, we can talk about Lincoln's execution, what he did, what he didn't do. I mean, that's fair game. But the starting point is this radical declaration that is so fervent. And so in that speech, in the same Gettysburg Address, you know, Lincoln gets down toward the end and says, "Now we're going to have a rebirth. We're gonna have this do over. We have this great foundation, but we've gotten off kilter." And I'll just say for a minute, we've gotten off kilter because it's important to remember what was edited out of the Declaration was a stinging critique on the slave trade. And that was the piece that was largely edited out of the text. My thinking was, and my understanding is, the founders were more concerned about independence and didn't want to get bogged down in secondary issues. And the efficacy of human bondage was obviously a secondary issue. But they punted on, so right there, you have this gap. They punted on slavery there. Then you get to the Constitution with the Three-Fifths Compromise. Sort of, again, a punt on slavery. The Missouri Compromise, a punt on slavery. Kansas-Nebraska Act, a punt on slavery. So by the time you get to the Civil War, there's no more punting. And that Lincoln then says, "We're going to have a rebirth. We're going to do it over." And he was alive, you know, for the vote on the 13th Amendment because he wasn't sure that he could just end slavery by executive fiat. And then you had, but the 13th Amendment, you had the original language of the 13th Amendment. Well, there was an amendment rather that Sumner offered, and justice for all. And that got struck down because they were afraid that women might want to vote. And so then you had the Civil Rights Bill, but Civil Rights Law Bill of 1866, and that didn't go far enough, which then gives you the 14th Amendment. And what the 14th Amendment does is the 14th Amendment takes the ethos of the Declaration of Independence and puts it right into the Constitution. It says equality. And so it takes the ethos of the Declaration and puts it into the Constitution. The other thing it also does is that it also introduces the doctrine of incorporation, which then said, you know, these Bill of Rights, or at least most of them, are now applicable to the state. So if we're going to say equal, you can't have one standard of equal in Nebraska and a different standard of equal in Alabama. So the ethos of the Declaration becomes firm. And this is all part of that rebirth that Lincoln talked about and envisioned.
So we've got the founding radical idea, and the text there is the Declaration, and then the other equally important text in American history rebirthing that radical idea are the 13th Amendment ending slavery, but really doing more than that, and the 14th Amendment especially in its guarantee of equal protection of the law. Let me talk about, you know, part of the book is you doing jazz and riffing and thinking about these ideas and how they've mattered still in American history and defending them, too, as a sort of common way of working through differences and pushing us forward. But there are also heroes of yours, I take it, that you're emulating. One of them is certainly Martin Luther King, and I know you and I have talked about it, and I was happy to see it in the book, that last speech that he gives. So let's hear some about King. Tell us about him. Tell us about this last speech and how he used the radical idea and how he related to it. And I have a related question, too, to the one I asked before about what we would say to those who think that we're really moderates, not radicals in buying.
All right, let me do the King first, because I'm not like you. I can't hold all that. So let me do this one first.
I have a simple question. Tell me about King and how he works in the book, and also why he's using a radical idea.
Well, King works in the book because Martin Luther King had this brilliant way of expanding the notion of we the people and expanding this notion that just because, and this sort of goes to your initial question to me, just because it may not have been the intent of the artisans, these are the words, and therefore we're going to hold the country accountable to those words. You had Lincoln cite the Declaration of Independence at the Gettysburg Address. 100 years later, on the steps of the Washington Monument, King is citing the exact same document to justify, what America needed to do in 1963. And in that very last speech, he's talking about equality for and dignity for sanitation workers. And he says, what we say to America, be true to what you said on paper. These are the things you committed to. We're not asking for anything other than what America has committed to. And that was sort of the ethos of the King philosophy through nonviolence. And I took that idea and tried to make it the ethos of my book. It's not about what anybody intended. It's not about what anybody wants. This is what it is.
Right. I mean, one of the things that I was struck by in reading it, and I remember a conversation with you when I was speaking at Wake Forest and to your group, that refrain in the speech, and certainly after we spoke, I went and watched it and read it and then saw your terrific treatment of it too in the book. And to me, the phrase that he uses that really sums up this idea, it's not about the intent. It's certainly not about going back to our very first conversation, the biography of Jefferson and was he good or not. It's about what they wrote and about the idea. And the refrain somewhere I read is really saying, it's in there.
Right.
Like I actually read it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what all this other history is. So I thought that really gets to your point.
Yeah,
about
that is my approach to text.
I'm
not saying I'm ambivalent about the fact that Thomas Jefferson owned slaves, but that's not a reason. That's not the point. I don't care.
Right. What did he write? And what did we read? Importantly, because, in a way, it doesn't matter what he was writing it for. What matters is what we're going to use it for and what we're able to read ourselves and do with it. And that King saying that over and over again, in sort of lyrical way, it's inspiring. You feel it. And of course, the fact that it's the last speech is gives it a whole other level of emotional content. So
moderates. You asked about moderates. That we're not moderates. Why is this radical?
Yeah, that was going to be my follow up. I mean, I think you've started to answer it, but do you think that, I guess one thing that I could ask that I think you will get from interviewers about the book is that the thing that might make you Byron, even though you in my view, we're radicals in the best sense, but I imagine people will say that the text is so bad on the thing that matters the most right now as we're going through this second Great Depression and going through the COVID crisis, which is economic justice and a sense of inequality and speaking out against massive inequalities and distribution of wealth. That's just not in the document, I could imagine somebody saying, and it's not the meaning of equality that we've been talking about so far, at least. So where's the economic justice in your vision, Byron? Or are you not a radical in that sense?
No. I think the economic justice ultimately comes from, and then I'll just start with the preamble of the Constitution. It comes from we the people. Now, one of the points that I make in the book is that, again, similar to Constitution interpretation, it doesn't matter whether or not I like the protests or the movement, but it matters this way. If you take the framers of the Declaration of Independence, and you take that movement, there is a line that you can draw that gets you to Black Lives Matter. And so the Declaration of Independence is a document that says we have an issue. Black Lives Matter says, we have an issue. The Declaration of Independence then says, we think this is how the issue should be addressed. Black Lives Matter says, we think this is how the issue should be addressed. And then in that, and this is all in one paragraph, by the way. And then it ends by saying, we are morally justified to pursue it this way. And Black Lives Matter is saying the exact same thing. So I would reject those and say, whereas the income inequality is not there. I mean, it's not there. It says, it does say equality, but the income inequality has to be addressed by us. But the declaration lays the predicate so that those who want economic justice can pursue it. And in doing so, they are right in step with the founders, with the artisans of the Declaration of Independence, in my view.
Yeah.
How is that for radical?
I love it. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and also your point, too, I don't want listeners to lose about Martin Luther King, that, you know, this was about justice for janitors, that he was out there on the picket line. And it wasn't like he was ignoring economic issues in that last breath. And that powerful speech is partly about that, of course. Let me go to sort of question two about, I mean, it connects, I think, to the entire book, really to our whole conversation as we get towards the end, which is, you know, some people might say, I face this a lot, and this is just something I want to think together about, which is, you know, we don't want to read the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, maybe the Declaration, but these cases shall be county. That's for lawyers, and that's something that judges do, and they have a kind of expertise that we don't. And, you know, I've spent, I think, most of my career not teaching law students, although I've done that a lot too, but teaching people who are going to be citizens, not lawyers. And my deep desire, and it's a desire that I see as central to your book, is to take these radical ideas and bring them directly to the people. So can you just say something about how you hope your book will succeed in furthering that mission, what the challenges are in getting people to see that these documents, these ideas are not just for lawyers and professionally changed.
Well, let's start with this. I'm not a lawyer.
I think that's an advantage. You know, I guess that's what I'm saying, frankly, that, you know, I am trained as a lawyer and I do sometimes teach in law schools, and I'm disgusted by the idea that somehow it's the legal profession that owns these ideas. It's not. It's, as you said, we the people. And how do we bring that back? That's the challenge that you're addressing, that you're doing. And I, you know, how can we together work to get people to care about what you and I are talking? Now, I know we care about it and we're happy to talk about it, but how do we spread this? It's a great question.
I think that there's a word that I like to use a lot also that I think is applicable here. If you understand the nuance of these texts, I think if more people, if you just say that, say Shelby or Plessy v. Ferguson, you know, use the 14th Amendment to justify Jim Crow segregation. So, I mean, that may glaze over. You and I may talk about that. That, you know, that may glaze over a lot of people. But if you said to them, how is it that you could use the 14th Amendment to justify Plessy v. Ferguson in 1896, and then in 1954, use the 14th Amendment to overthrow Plessy v. Ferguson. And it's something that's applicable to everybody's life. I mean, so these texts are important, and they're not the private domain of lawyers. I mean, I've had people email me about my weekly column. You're not a lawyer. How can you talk about the Constitution? Because I'm a citizen. That's why I can talk about the Constitution.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the right response. And I think, too, just going back to your point and your example, you know, maybe people don't know the name of the case, but they've heard of Separate But Equal, and they have a view of it. And, you know, what's great about the book and about the discussion group and the larger discussion that you and I have been having is that these moral principles are not the domain of some special profession. They're the domain of citizens in a democracy who want to, you know, who can feel them and who can understand them and who can defend them and know what they are. And that's, I think, what's great about the book and the challenge of, you know, your column and the radio show is to engage people in a moral discussion about the Constitution. And that's something that we've just lost by these so-called experts beating us down with their fake history with their legalese and trying to hide the reality that you're bringing out, which is, no, this is about morality. It's about, well, it's the name of the show. It's about a public morality.
Well, the one of the things I like to say, the way I like to frame it, Corey, is that I call my radio show, I was the public morality. And the reason so is because it comes from the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Emancipation right. Proclamation. The way I sum that up, the Declaration is what it is. And the Constitution is the how. And the Emancipation comes along with this because we are these other two things, we're going to do this. And so that sort of frames, in my view, this public morality. And that it is open for all of us. I mean, if someone sees me as liberal, if someone sees me as non-radical, I mean, what I hope to do was to leave space for dialogue. I'm my book, I'm not trying to be the last word, you know, on this subject. I'm trying to create some space where someone who's diametrically opposed, you know, people of different social locations based on gender, orientation, race, can all see how these issues of power and oppression, how they, and they all have a valid truth. How do people with different income levels have a conversation about these documents and still have a valid truth? That's what the project is, in my view.
I think part of the challenge too is sort of building people's confidence once you start to do it and you start to own these materials and to have views about it. It gets harder for the professionals and the so-called experts to beat you down. I'll tell a quick story, which is that, and just on this theme, that when Justice Kavanaugh was going through his confirmation hearing, not my favorite justice, as you know, he was asked about a piece I had written saying, you know, don't trust this guy. He has a radical view, not radical in the sense of the ideas that we're talking about, but a radical view of how powerful the president is. Unlimited presidency, basically, was my worry. And he said, well, Senator, he's not a law professor, when he was asked about this piece. And I felt like, wow, this guy is everything. This was before Blasey Ford's accusation, too. I thought this guy is everything that's wrong with the way that people think about the Constitution. And, you know, kudos to you for pushing back and really empowering people to take these texts, to own them. They are in the public domain, and they're things that we should take ownership of, I think. So thanks for writing this book.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Public Morality with guest host Corey Brettschneider. I've been interviewing the normal host, Byron Williams, about his new book. And my sincere hope is that you'll check it out, because this isn't a book just for historians, although I think a lot of historians will learn from it. It's not just for lawyers, although lawyers need to read it and will learn for it. It's a book for everyone, for all the people. And it's a continuation of his public-spirited dialogues in North Carolina and his radio show that you've been listening to, The Public Morality. And it's a real tribute to how to take the framers' ideas and make them live today for all of us in a way that will further justice going forward. So, Byron, I just want to thank you for all that you've done and for writing the book. And thank you to the listeners, too.
And I want to thank today's guest host, Professor Corey Brettschneider. The Public Morality welcomes your comments. You can contact me at byron@publicmorality.org. That's Byron, B-Y-R-O-N, @publicmorality.org. You can follow me on Facebook as well as Twitter. The archive broadcast can be found on iTunes and SoundCloud. And once again, I want to thank Elvin Jenkins and Michael Burns at WJAB in Huntsville, Alabama, for allowing us to broadcast The Public Morality at their studios. The Public Morality is produced at WSNC on the campus of Winston-Salem State University. And in the words of Martin Luther King, we may have all come on different ships, but we're in the same boat now. For all of us at The Public Morality, I'm Byron Williams.